The following program is a PBS Wisconsin original production.
Republicans and a handful of Democrats make quick work of the state budget this week. The nearly $88 billion plan clears both houses and lands on Governor Evers' desk, where a veto pen awaits. And even as state lawmakers moved on the budget, a presidential visit in La Crosse. That's where President Joe Biden touted his infrastructure plan.
I'm Frederica Freiberg. Tonight on Here and Now, Zach Schultz dissects the budget plan now headed to the governor's desk. U.S. Representative Gwen Moore is here to talk about infrastructure money and ongoing efforts to replace lead pipes in Milwaukee. And Marissa Wojcik talks with an epidemiologist about the rise of non-COVID respiratory illnesses among Wisconsin children. It's Here and Now for July 2.
Funding for Here and Now is provided by the Focus Fund for Journalism and Friends of PBS Wisconsin.
His budget had dramatic tax increases. It had massive increases in spending, expansions of welfare, legalizing marijuana, all kinds of social policy issues that the Joint Finance Committee took out of the budget and reconfigured to make sure that this reflects the priorities of all of Wisconsin, not just liberal Democrats in certain parts of the state.
The only explanation for how the Republicans crafted their budget in stark contrast to Governor Evers is that the biggest priority, as it has been from when Governor Evers was elected, from the lame duck session to other things, is their goal is to try to do everything possible to obstruct, oppose, and undermine Governor Evers.
After the partisan finger-pointing, the nearly $88 billion two-year state budget is now in the hands of Governor Tony Evers because the legislature passed the spending plan this week, and now the governor, who wields the most powerful veto pen in the nation, scours the document before signing up or down or making partial strikethroughs. Republican budget riders included more than $3 billion in tax cuts while nixing Evers items like expanded Medicaid and more money for schools. Senior political reporter Zach Schultz joins us now from the Capitol with what's next. And Zach, thanks a lot for being here.
My pleasure, Fred.
So interestingly, unlike past budgets, some Assembly Democrats voted for this one. What was that about? Was it about the tax cuts?
Well, I think you have to look at the geography of where those Democrats are from. In both the Assembly and the Senate, they represent western and northwestern Wisconsin, where at the top of the ticket, at least, the electorate has shifted more Republican. So they're covering up for a more conservative electorate that's still keeping them in office. One of the members in the Assembly had just flipped a Republican suburban district in Milwaukee. So they have to cover their base of who they have at home. And remember, there's not a lot of nuance in voting for a budget. This budget has lots of things any lawmaker likes or doesn't like, but you only get to say yes or no. And so you have to be pretty clear on what you want the ultimate message to be to your voters back home.
So how do Republicans regard this spending plan?
Well, they absolutely love it. This is the first time that all the Republicans have voted for a budget in quite a while. In past budgets, you've seen some of the conservative Republicans say, we still don't support it because it doesn't do enough or it doesn't go far enough. I mean, Republicans build their brand around tax cuts, and that's what's in this budget. So they absolutely love it.
And Democrats, and by extension, Governor Evers?
Well, they're focused mainly on the education spending. They're worried that there's not enough in there, that the Republican focus was strictly on maintenance of effort, that federal requirement that allows the federal COVID relief dollars to come in, but not actually providing any additional state support, and how that may fall out in the actual school district and when it comes to funding the operations of a school.
So Evers has this mighty veto pen. What can he do and what can't he do?
Well, there have been restrictions back to the Tommy Thompson era and Jim Doyle. We've used constitutional amendments approved by the voters to narrow just a little bit what can be struck and what can't be. So it's not as big a pen as it used to be. He can still reduce numbers, although it seems unlikely. He can strike out some words or language, but Republicans have been extremely careful to make sure that they don't put the words in there that he could use to strike out. So they've taken out references to may not exceed, just in case Evers says, strikes out the not and says, may exceed. So a lot of that language is a cat and mouse game when it comes to how the budget is written from the legislature side, and then how Evers and his team view the budget, what they can do with the veto pen.
There was some discussion of this earlier, but if he vetoed the whole thing, Wisconsin would lose, I understand, that more than $2 billion in federal school funding, right?
Yeah, there really is no option right now for the governor to veto the whole document, because Republicans have said they won't come back. They won't give him another budget to work with. This is it. And really, it would be pinned on the governor if the schools didn't get the federal funding and they still didn't have more state support in the mix. Add in the fact that there were Democrats who supported this on the floor in both chambers. That showed that they realized that the governor was going to have to make his changes through partial veto as opposed to vetoing the whole document.
But meanwhile, Wisconsin saw a $4.4 billion tax revenue win fall, notwithstanding the economic strain of COVID. When was the last time that there was this much to work with?
Well, you have to go back a couple decades ago. Back in Tommy Thompson's era, remember they sent home surplus checks to everyone. They just wrote a check out to be, but that was the difference between how we're structuring it now under this budget and back then. Back then, they sent home one-time surplus, but the revenue was still there for the next time. These tax cuts are permanent. So the property, personal property tax is gone. These tax brackets are lowered. Those don't just come back. So if this money came in because of increased COVID spending, those stimulus dollars and the increased unemployment benefits being spent and surging the economy, that won't happen in the next budget. So it's a big question of what will the budget picture look like then?
Well, aside from kind of the process of all of this, which, you know, probably most people don't care as much about, what stands out for how people in Wisconsin will be impacted by a two-year state spending plan?
Well, the main thing is if you're middle income or higher, you're going to see tax benefits. You're going to enjoy those tax benefits. Everyone else, it's a question of how much they are and whether it really impacts your life. But the other big, big fallout is going to be in public schools. If that federal money isn't able to replace enough of the operational spending that they didn't get from the state, we've heard schools already talk about having to make cuts or possibly layoffs, which would seem incongruous in a time with all this money coming in. But that's a real big concern, and how that plays out will definitely impact the next budget and the next election.
Huh. Well, Zach, thank you very much, and thank you for covering this. Appreciate it. Now to federal dollars and President Joe Biden's infrastructure plan, a plan he touted this week in La Crosse. Here and Now reporter Will Keneally was there.
We're here to welcome President Biden back to the great state of Wisconsin.
President Joe Biden visited La Crosse Tuesday to pitch his plan for strengthening the country's infrastructure.
In November 2019, a school bus in Arcadia, Wisconsin, tipped over going around a curve, went into a ditch with 20 students on board. It wasn't because of snow or ice. It was just an old country road with rough conditions. Thank God nobody was seriously injured at the time. But this is a drain on our economy as well.
On top of roads, Biden cited broadband as an example of ways investing in infrastructure could strengthen the economy.
No farmer here in Wisconsin should lose business because they don't have reliable connection to the internet. No one to buy, no one to sell, and know what's going on. You know, back in 1936, the federal government brought electricity to nearly every home and farm in America, and it set the stage for a massive, sustained economic boom that would follow World War II. High-speed internet is the equivalent of that today.
The $1.2 trillion plan still faces hurdles in Congress. Republicans balked at the bill after Democrats attempted to add their own partisan priorities to the previously bipartisan bill. Some moderate Republicans said they were assured by Biden that he would not tie up the bill over those Democratic priorities. Those outreach efforts were well received by Wisconsinites.
I think President Biden is really, he's taking some heat now from his own constituents because he's willing to work with the Republicans. And I think in the on the infrastructure, and I think in the long run that will pay off for him.
I think he's doing a wonderful job of managing everything, even with all of the obstruction. And I think he really understands families and communities and the importance of them.
Republicans fired back, however, accusing Biden of being out of touch with what Wisconsinites need.
Everybody wants infrastructure, but we want it targeted. We don't want, you know, these far left policies mixed into the infrastructure bill. You know, hopefully he comes and realizes that's, you know, what Wisconsin wants. That's what, you know, middle rural America needs. And hopefully he takes that back to D.C. with them.
Under the current plan, Wisconsin would be the beneficiary of various improvements, including upgrades to roughly 1,000 bridges in the state. Also in the investments, tackling lead water lines in Milwaukee.
Milwaukee has more than 160,000 water service lines. More than 70,000 of them, nearly half, have lead service lines. This deal contains the largest investment in clean drinking water and wastewater infrastructure in American history.
Reporting from La Crosse, this is Will Keneally for Here and Now.
Here and Now, student journalist Kim Leadholm also contributed to our coverage in La Crosse this week. As we just heard, President Biden is eager for infrastructure money to find its way to Milwaukee, a city that faces public health risks related to lead pipes and drinking water. U.S. Representative Gwen Moore is also concerned about the dangers of lead pipes and paint in her Milwaukee district. She joins us now from Washington, and thanks very much for being here again.
Oh, thanks for having me, Frederica.
So even as the Senate grapples with an infrastructure bill, the House just passed its own measure that includes like $45 billion to replace lead water lines across the nation. Representative Moore, how keenly needed is that in Milwaukee?
Well, Frederica, thanks for asking, because, you know, so many people talk about the situation in Flint, Michigan, but this is a problem all over the country, especially in older cities. In the city of Milwaukee, we have 2,500 cases a year of children who are poisoned by lead. And as you know, there's no safe amount of lead. It leads to all kinds of cognitive disabilities, perhaps even violent behavior. It's a lifelong tragedy for kids. And this $45 billion over the next 10 years will take every single lead pipe in the country out. And it'll take out the lead pipes we have in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin. And of course, at the rate that we're going and at the funding levels that we have in Milwaukee, it would take 70 years in order to do it without this appropriation. So we're very, very delighted.
So what share of federal relief and infrastructure funds need to be aimed at your city? Because I understand replacing all the lead service lines alone in Milwaukee would run like $800 million. What share would you like to see go to Milwaukee for that?
$800 million? Actually, Frederica, I have made efforts throughout my tenure in Congress to provide monies for these lead pipes. And so to the extent that there would be any sort of city match, we have built that into, the mayor has built this into his budget. So we have been plodding along. We just have not had enough money to do them all. And of course, you have heard the screaming from community activists, rightfully so, about the crisis that this is and wanting to get it done. So we're going to use this federal money to really leverage what we're already doing locally.
So if this gets tied up in Washington, what would you say about another generation of Milwaukeeans growing up under the specter of lead poisoning?
Well, you know, Frederica, thanks for asking that. You know, we've known for a long time that lead was not good. I mean, even, you know, back in ancient times, it's just stupid that we haven't done something beforehand. But as we see bridges crumbling, buildings crumbling, I think that, you know, we all have a shared interest at this point to take this stuff very seriously. And another generation of children growing up under lead is going to be devastating to our economy. This is our future workforce. You know, when I found out that my second granddaughter was pregnant with my first great grandchild, I immediately started buying water. That was my reaction to that. And, you know, and not only will it ameliorate all of these health problems, but it really adds to our GDP. You know, one of my colleagues, Brian Higgins from Buffalo on the Ways and Means Committee, is constantly talking about the return on these dollars. I mean, for every dollar we spend on infrastructure, we get about $3.72 in return. So it, and it really, really adds to our GDP. You know, economists say that 28,000 jobs will be created for this with just $1 billion of these monies. And so it's an economic boon, and it really mitigates the health risks that we face. We can't afford, you know, we can't do this knowing better. It'd be different if we didn't know what the draconian impacts are, but we know better.
On a related matter, you were just named to the Select Committee on Economic Disparity and Fairness in Growth. What is the task of that committee, and what do you bring to that work?
Well, thank you. I was so honored to be selected by Speaker Pelosi to serve on this task force. It has some of the brightest and best minds in our conference on the committee. You know, we have people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's coming there to sort of bring the perspective of disparities and inequality among young people, this generation who's burdened with disparities, you know, like having more grant money, more loan money for education rather than some of the grant money that that people in my generation were able to have. We have Angie Craig from Minnesota, who's gonna talk about the kinds of desperation and despair that exists in rural areas. We have Sarah Jacobs, who's gonna talk about the future of work, and Primala Jayapal, who is the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. And so we're gonna have a lot of different voices. You know, I'm gonna bring the voice of poverty and those left behind as a result of poverty to the table. You know, our chairman, Jim Hines from Connecticut, has commissioned us to bring our thinking caps on and to bring facts to the table. We're not gonna spend a whole lot of time with anecdotes and so forth. This is going to be a serious charge, looking at not just identifying the problems, but looking for solutions.
All right. We need to leave it there, but we will be watching that interesting and important work. Representative Gwen Moore, thank you very much.
And thank you, Frederica. Happy for it.
In just a moment, we will hear from a state epidemiologist about respiratory viruses hitting children and the interplay with COVID-19, and also about the new Delta variant. Now, people who are vaccinated are mostly protected from that new variant. But at a time when vaccinations are not only protecting people, but leading to a back-to-normal lifestyle, Wisconsin U.S. Senator Ron Johnson is focusing on the downside of vaccines. At a Milwaukee press conference this week, he introduced a group of people who experienced negative side effects from getting the shot.
None of us are medical doctors. None of us are medical researchers. We're not pretending to be. But we can see the publicly available information. We can look at the numbers. We can take a look at this data and go, this is concerning. This ought to be taken seriously. This ought to be looked at.
Wisconsin medical professionals gathered this week in a Zoom event to take exception to Senator Johnson's stand on vaccinations, including a community health clinic physician from Milwaukee.
Senator Ron Johnson is extremely out of place in trying to give medical advice. Not only that, because of his position of power, Ron Johnson is extremely dangerous. I worry that events like the one Senator Johnson held yesterday will cost the lives of people here in Milwaukee and across our state. That's why I'm here with my colleagues today. As physicians, we call on Senator Ron Johnson to do the responsible thing, share with people that COVID-19 vaccines are demonstrably safe and effective, and encourage people to protect themselves against COVID-19 by getting vaccinated.
The state's largest newspaper had scathing words for Senator Johnson in an editorial this week that maligned him for continuing to cast doubt about science. They wrote, quote, He is the most irresponsible representative of Wisconsin citizens since the infamous Senator Joseph R. McCarthy in the 1950s. Meanwhile, health officials continue to encourage people to get COVID-19 vaccinations, especially in the face of new variants. Those same health providers are seeing something new in children this summer, an unexpected rise in non-COVID respiratory viruses that has sent up to 80 children to the hospital with flu-like symptoms. The State Department of Health Services is warning people to stay home if they are sick. On this week's Noon Wednesday, Marissa Wojcik spoke with respiratory disease epidemiologist Tom Haupt to learn more.
Now, you refer to these non-COVID-related seasonal respiratory viruses as RSVs. There's also a rise in parainfluenza cases. When do we typically see a rise in these cases, and why are they rising right now?
Well, RSV, or respiratory syncytial virus, commonly known as RSV, is a winter virus. It usually follows the influenza season by about a month or so. So we should be out of the RSV season by now, but we've saw nothing during the winter time, as was the case with influenza. We did not see any RSV. And for some reason, it's starting to reappear right now. The reason for it behind it, we just don't know for sure. There's theories that, it's been 18, 19 months since we've had RSV. Maybe it's just time that it reappeared. We just really are kind of shocked that it did reappear. Parainfluenza, on the other hand, usually is a late spring, early summer season. So that's pretty typical. But another virus that we're seeing is seasonal coronavirus, the non-coronavirus, the non-COVID coronaviruses. And again, they're winter viruses as well. And we should not be seeing them at this particular time. It remains to be seen why this is happening. I mean, we've talked about it on a national level. Nobody has a real answer for it at this point.
Now, why does the rise in these viruses have health officials like yourself concerned?
Well, one thing we're concerned about is that people might become complacent. You know, now that COVID is at very, very low numbers, we are very concerned that people may think that they have respiratory symptoms, maybe a cough and sneezing, and then it's just allergies. They think they're not infectious. But if these viruses actually got introduced into a setting like a long-term care facility or a daycare, it could be devastating. I mean, it could spread like wildfire, and it could cause severe illness in the elderly population and young children. We have been in touch with a lot of the hospitals that have pediatric units, and they are all telling us that they're seeing higher than normal numbers from viruses other than COVID, including RSV, including parainfluenza. And unfortunately, some of these children are so sick that they have to be admitted into the intensive care unit.
Now, people are becoming more concerned about the more contagious Delta variant of COVID-19 that's spreading, and children under the age of 12 are still unable to get vaccinated against COVID-19. Is it difficult to decipher the symptoms of these other respiratory viruses from COVID-19 and its variants?
You make a really good point, Marissa. It is very difficult. The only way to know what virus you are carrying and perhaps spreading is through testing, because the symptoms are extremely similar. So we really can't distinguish between any of them, COVID, influenza, any of these particular viruses, other than doing some testing.
What do you foresee? We have summer activities, and the age group that you described as young children are very active in the summer. And then what does it mean for going back to school in the fall?
The big thing is using good hygiene, really good hygiene. Respect others who are around you. Try to limit the spread as much as you possibly can. But another issue is daycare. There's been a lot of daycare outbreaks. And unfortunately, we haven't had one in Wisconsin as yet, but we're continuing to monitoring that situation. But I know for a fact several other states have had very large outbreaks of 15 to 20, maybe even 30 children who have come down with these different types of viruses. Parents cannot send their children to daycares. You know, you don't want them to give them a little bit of a fever reducer just so they can be eligible to get into the daycare and then have to pick them up 4 hours later. We really need to have good compliance from all the parents and just practice our good hygiene and keep pushing it.
For those who are eligible to get a vaccine, will getting a vaccine help decipher between what kind of virus someone might be contracting?
It could. I mean, with the we certainly encourage influenza vaccine and COVID vaccine. You know, as far as the other viruses, the symptoms are, signs and symptoms are pretty much the same. So again, the only way you're really going to know is to test. But the benefit of being vaccinated against COVID and against influenza is that you don't have any of these, you won't have any co-viruses. You won't have RSV and COVID together, which again could be deadly for anyone, any population to have multiple different viruses at a time. So again, we encourage vaccine as quickly as possible. If you haven't got COVID vaccine, please consider it for yourself and for the people who are around you.
Health officials are encouraging anyone experiencing these symptoms to wear a mask and socially distance. You can see the complete Noon Wednesday interview by going to pbswisconsin.org and clicking on the news page. Before we leave you tonight, we return to the state capitol, the site where Zach Schultz joined us at the top of the show. Now, that pretty camera shot was compliments of a man by the name of Mike Eicher. Today is his last day on the job at PBS Wisconsin. If you have watched us for the past several decades, you've seen Mike's work many times over. His camera has traveled the globe with him during his time with us, not to mention countless hours of committee hearings up there at the state capitol. He has a cabinet of awards for his efforts. Now, television is a visual medium, and PBS Wisconsin is proud of our look. Mike Eicher is a huge part of our look, and we will miss him. And so tonight, at our request, Mike points the camera at himself for once. And Mike, give us a wave goodbye. Thank you for all you have given us, and a very happy retirement. Oh, my. That is our program for tonight. I'm Frederica Freiberg. Have a great weekend.
Funding for Here and Now is provided by the Focus Fund for Journalism and Friends of PBS Wisconsin.